I craved solitude and surcease from pain, and both I found at the City of the Moon. Eldridge had a month's lecturing commitments to meet in England. Sally had disappeared. I'd not spoken to her since that night, but Lurin told me casually that she'd taken 2 weeks of her accumulated vacation time and had joined a tour to Italy and the Greek islands. At the City of the Moon, an airmail letter from Sally reached me, postmarked Padua, confirming this and regretting that her efforts to see me before I left London had failed. This was not surprising, for I hadn't returned to the Dorchester, but had my luggage sent to Bluebird House and flown out on the early morning flight for Africa. Sally sent her congratulations and ended by saying she would return to Johannesburg at the end of the month and take advantage of the first flight to the City of the Moon. Reading her letter gave me a feeling of unreality, like receiving a message from beyond the grave, for she was dead to me, gone beyond my reach forever. I burnt the letter. Lurin visited the site for one day. I found that I had nothing to say to him. It was as though we were strangers. His features, once so well remembered and beloved, were unfamiliar to me now. He sensed the gap that separated us, and tried to reach across it. I couldn't respond, and he cut short his visit and left. I knew his puzzlement, and vaguely I regretted it. I couldn't find it in myself to blame or hate him. Rail and Leslie were shadowy figures on the borders of my solitude. They did not intrude in the private world in which I now lived. This was the world of Hui Ben Ammon, a place beyond pain and sorrow. During this time that Eldridge worked upon the scrolls, I'd followed each detail daily of his translation. Language is my greatest talent. It comes to me without effort. Lawrence of Arabia learned to speak Arabic in 4 days. In 10, I taught myself Punic, and in so doing had gained the key to the fairyland of the golden books of Hui. The third book was a continuation of the history of Opit up to the lifetime of the poet. This was as fascinating a document as the two that preceded it, but the true magic for me was in the remaining two golden books. These were the poems and songs of Hui, poems and songs in the modern sense of the words. This was Hui the warrior, the axeman of all the gods, writing an ode to the shiny wing of the bird of the sun, his battle axe. He described the ore brought from the mines of the south and its smelting in the womb-shaped furnace, the smell of the glowing charcoal and the trickle of the molten metal, how it was purged and alloyed, forged and shaped, its edging and engraving. And when he described the figures of the four vultures and the four suns, I looked up at the great axe that hung above my working desk with wonder. With Hui, I heard the gleaming blade moan in flight, heard the snick of the edge into bone, the sucking withdrawal from living flesh. I read with awe the list of the enemies who had died beneath it, and wondered at their crimes and transgressions. Then Hui's mood changed, and he was a roistering fellow, tipping back the jug of red Zeng wine, roaring with laughter in the firelight with his companions in arms. Now he was the dandy, dressed in white linen, perfumed with sweet oils, his beard twisted and plaited into ropes. Now the priest, walking with his gods, sure of them, tending to their mysteries, and rendering unto them their portion of the sacrifice. Hui, kneeling alone in silent prayer. Hui in the dawn, lifting his arms in greeting to Baal, the sun god. Hui in a frenzy of religious revelation. Then again Hui as the friend, the true companion, describing his joy in the company of another man. The interlock of personalities, the spice of shared pleasures, dangers faced together and overcome. There is a strong hint in this poem that Hui is a hero worshipper, blind to the faults of his friend, describing his physical beauty with an almost womanly insight. He details the breadth of shoulder, the regal curve of flaming red beard down onto a chest where the muscle bulges smooth and hard as the boulders upon the hills of Zamboa, the legs like strong saplings, the smile like the warm blessing of the sun god Baal. And he ends with the line, Lannan Hyrcanus, you are more than king of Opit. You are my friend. Reading it, I felt that to have the friendship of Hui was to have something of value. The mood of the poet changes again, and he is the observer of nature, the hunter, describing his quarry with loving care, missing no detail from the curve in the ivory tusk to the creamy softness of a lioness's underbelly. Then he is a lover, bemused by the beauty of his sweetheart. Tanith, whose wide brow is shining white and full as the moon, whose hair blows soft and light as the smoke from the great papyrus fires in the swamps, whose eyes shine green as the deep pool in the temple of the goddess Astarte. And then suddenly Tanith is dead, and the poet cries his grief, seeing her death as the flight of a bird, her ivory arms gleaming like spread wings, her last cry echoing across the vault of heaven to touch the hearts of the gods themselves. Hui's lament was mine. His voice was mine. His terrors and triumphs became my own. And it seemed that Hui was me and I was Hui. I rose early and retired late. I ate little and my face grew gaunt and pale. A haunted face that stared back at me from my mirror with wild eyes. And then suddenly reality caught up with me, shattering the crystal walls of my fairyland. On the same aircraft, Lorin and Sally arrived together at the City of the Moon. The torment which I had for so long avoided had now begun again. Again I tried to hide. I chose the archives as my sanctuary, and spent each day there trying to avoid all contact with either Sally or Lorin. Still there was that dreaded hour of the evening meal, trying to smile my way through it and join in the banter and discussion, trying not to notice the private intimate exchange of glances and smiles between Lorin and Sally until I could reasonably leave. Twice Lorin came to me. There's something wrong, Ben. No, Lorin, no, I swear to you, you're mistaken. And I escaped to the stillness of the archives. There was Ral's quiet company, and the physical labour of cataloguing, photographing, and packing the jars, and besides these I found other distraction. This cavern, sealed for almost 2,000 years, had been sterile, devoid of any life form, when first we opened it. Now it was establishing its own ecology. First the tiny midge flies, then sand fleas, ants, spiders, moths, and finally the little brown gecko lizards. I had started making a film record of this colonization of the archives. I spent many hours a day, sitting quietly with my camera poised, waiting to obtain some difficult close-up shot of fly or insect. And it was thus that I made the last major discovery at the City of the Moon. I was working alone at the furthest end of the archives, close by the wall on which was graven the image of the sun. One of the gecko lizards ran down the wall and across the stone floor. At the spot where the great battle axe had lain, when we discovered it, the lizard stopped. It stood poised, the soft skin of its throat pulsing, and its little black beady eyes shiny with expectation. I noticed then the insect it was stalking. A white moth that sat quietly with spread wings on the sun image. Quickly I reached for my camera and set the flash bulb in exposure. I was anxious to record one of the lizards in the moment of its kill. Slowly I moved into a position from which I could focus on the moth, and I waited while the lizard approached it in a series of swift dashes. 12 inches from the moth, it stopped again, and seemed to gather itself for the final assault. I waited breathlessly, my finger on the trigger button. The lizard shot forward, and I exploded the bulb. The lizard froze, with the body of the moth crammed in its mouth, and then it turned and darted head downwards towards the floor. When it reached the corner formed by wall and floor, it disappeared. and I laughed at its ludicrous fright. I wound the film, replaced the flash bulb, returned the camera to its case, and was about to resume my work when a thought occurred to me. I went to the end wall of the cavern, to the point where the lizard had disappeared, and stooped to examine the juncture of floor and wall. It seemed solid, and I could see no hole or crack for the lizard to use as a refuge. Intrigued now by the lizard's disappearance, I went to fetch one of the electric arc lights on its cable and set it so that the beam fully illuminated the wall. Then, on hands and knees, I crawled along the wall. I felt my heart start to pound like a war drum, and the hum of blood in my ears, the warmth of in my cheeks. My hand, as I reached for my penknife, was unsteady, and I nearly broke my thumbnail as I tried to open the blade. Then I was probing the faint crack line, plugged with dust, that separated wall and floor. The blade of my knife slipped into the crack to its full length. I rocked back on my heels and stared at the wall, seeing the image of the sun throwing weird shadows in the arc light. "Perhaps," I whispered aloud, "it's just possible." And then I was grovelling again beneath the image of Baal, almost as though I were one of his worshippers. Frantically I probed the crack, following it along the floor, until abruptly it turned 90 degrees and climbed the wall. Here the crack was secret jointed, riveted, and turned back into itself, making it all but invisible. The cunning skill with which this joint had been concealed convinced me that it hid something vital. The workmanship of this piece of the wall was a far cry from the rough joints on the roof slabs through which the dust had filtered down. Now I jumped up and paced restlessly back and forth before the blank wall. I was alive again, for the first time since my return to the City of the Moon. My skin tingled, my step was full of spring. My fists clenched and unclenched, and my brain was racing with excitement. "Lorin," I thought suddenly, "he should be here." I almost ran back down the archives and out through the tunnel. In the wooden guard hut which enclosed the entrance to the tunnel, one of the security guards was sprawled in a chair with his boots on the desk. The collar of his blue uniform was unbuttoned, his cap pushed back on his head. On the wall behind him, his gun belt hung from a hook, with the black butt of the revolver sticking out of the holster. He looked up from his paperback, Weston, a thick, beaky-nosed face with cold, eagle eyes. "Hi, Doc. You're in a hurry? Boltz, can you get hold of Mr. Stervison for me, and ask him to come up here right away?" When Lorin arrived, I was on my knees below the sun image. "Lo, come over here. I want to show you something." "Hey, Ben," Lorin laughed, and it seemed to me that his expression was one of relieved pleasure. "That's the first time I've seen you really smile in 2 weeks. God, I was worried about you." He slapped my shoulder, still laughing. "This is more like the old Ben again. Lo, look at this." And he knelt beside me. 10 minutes later, he was no longer smiling. His face was cold and intent. He was staring at the wall with those pale blue eyes as though he were seeing through the solid rock. "Lo," I began. But he waved me to silence with a peremptory gesture. He never took his eyes from the wall, and now it seemed to me that he was listening to a voice I couldn't hear. I watched that cold, godlike face with a sudden feeling of almost superstitious awe. I had a premonition of something unnatural about to happen. Slowly, step by step, Lorin approached the sun image. His hand went out and lay against the center of the great disk. His fingers were spread, seeming to echo the shape of the image. He began to press against the wall. I saw the tips of his fingers flatten against the rock, changing shape beneath the pressure of his hand. For a few long seconds, nothing happened, and then, suddenly, the wall began to move. There was no sound, no grating, or squeal of protesting hinge. But the whole wall began to revolve upon a concealed axis. A ponderous, deliberate movement that revealed the square, dark opening to a further passageway concealed beyond the image of Baal. Staring into that dark, prehistoric opening, I whispered without glancing at Lorin, "How did you do that, Lo? How did you guess?" His tone as he replied was puzzled. "I knew. I just knew, that's all." We were both silent again, staring into the opening. I was seized by a sudden, unaccountable dread of what we would find in there. "Get the light, Ben," Lorin ordered without taking his eyes from the doorway. I fetched the portable arc light, and Lorin took it from my hand. I followed him as he walked through the doorway. Before us, a passageway slanted down into the earth, at an angle of 45 degrees. The passage was 7 foot 6 inches high and 9 feet wide. There was a flight of stone steps cut into the floor. Each step was worn, with edges smoothed and rounded. The walls and roof of the tunnel were of unadorned stone, and the depth of the tunnel were hidden from us by shadow and darkness. "What's this?" And Lorin pointed at two large circular objects which lay at the head of the staircase. I saw the gleam of bronze rosettes upon them. "Shields," I told him. "War shields. Someone dropped them in a hurry." We stepped over them carefully and started down the staircase. They were 106 steps, each 6 inches high. "No dust in here," Lorin remarked. "No," I agreed. "The seal of the door was tight." His words should have acted as a warning, but I was lost in the wonder and excitement of this new discovery. The surface of the stairs was as clean as though freshly swept. At the bottom of the staircase, we reached a T-junction. On our right, the passage led to a gate of barred ironwork, which was closed and bolted. On the left, it descended another twisting staircase that disappeared into the living rock. "Which way?" Lorin asked. "Well, let's see what's behind the gate," I suggested, in a voice choking with excitement. And we went to it. The heavy bolts were not locked, but a thread of gold wire was twisted round the jamb of the gate, and a heavy clay seal closed the entrance. The figure on the seal was of a crudely wrought animal, and the words, "Lannan Hycanus, Grey Lion of Opet, King of Punt and the Four Kingdoms." "Give me your knife," Lorin said. No, we can't," I began. "Give it to me, damn you." His voice was shaking, thick with a peculiar lust and passion. "You know what this is? It's the treasury, the gold vaults of Opet." Wait, Lo. Wait, let's do it properly," I pleaded. But he took the seal in his bare hands and ripped it from the gate. "Don't do it, Lo," I protested. But he pulled the bolts open and flung his weight against the gate. It was rusted closed, but he attacked it with all his weight. It gave, swinging back far enough for Lorin to squeeze through. He ran forward and I ran after him. The tunnel turned again at right angles and led directly into a large chamber. "God!" shouted Lorin. "Oh, God! Look at it, Ben! Just look at it!" The treasury of Opet lay before us with all its fabulous wealth untouched. Later we could count and weigh and measure it, but now we stood and stared. The chamber was 186 feet long and 21 wide. The ivory was stacked along most of one wall. There were 1,016 large elephant tusks. The ivory was rotten and crumbly as chalk, but in itself must have been a vast treasure 2,000 years ago. There were over 900 large amphorae sealed with wax. The contents of precious oils had long since evaporated into a congealed black mess. There were bolts of imported linen and silk, rotted now so that they crumbled to dust at the touch. The metals were stacked along the opposite wall of the vault. 190 tons of native copper, cast into ingots shaped like the cross of St. Andrew. 3 tons of tin, cast into the same shape, 16 tons of silver, 96 of lead, and 2 of antimony. We walked down the aisle along the centre of the vault, staring about us at this incredible display of wealth.
"The gold," Lurin muttered. "Where's the gold?"
There was a stack of wooden chests, carved from ebony, the lids decorated with ivory and mother-of-pearl inlay. These were the only objects of an artistic nature in the vault, and even they were crudely executed battle scenes or hunting scenes. "No, no, don't do it, Lo," I cried another protest, as Lurin began ripping open the lids. They were filled with semi-precious stones, amethyst, beryl, tiger's eyes, jade, and malachite. Some of these were crudely cut and incorporated in gold jewelry, thick, clumsy pieces, collars, brooches, necklaces, and rings. Lurin hurried on down the aisle, and then stopped abruptly. In another recess that led off the main chamber, behind another iron gate, the gold was stacked in neat piles, cast in the usual finger molds. The piles of precious metal were insignificant in bulk, but when, months later, it was all weighed, the total was over 60 tons. Its value was in excess of £60 million. In the same recess as the gold were 2 small wooden chests. These yielded 26,000 carats of uncut and rough-cut diamonds of every conceivable colour and shape. Not one of these was smaller than 1.5 carats, and the largest was a big, sulky yellow monster of 38 carats, and this added a further £2 million to the intrinsic value of the treasure. Here was the wealth of 47 kings of Opet, accumulated painstakingly over the course of 400 years. No other treasure of antiquity could compare with this profusion. "We'll have to be bloody careful, Ben. No word of this must leak out. You understand what might happen if it did?" He stood with a finger of solid gold in each hand, looking down on the piles of treasure. "This is enough to kill for, to start a war." "What do you want me to do, Lo? I must have help in here. Ral, or Sally even." "No," he turned on me ferociously, "no one else will be allowed in here. I will leave orders with the guards. No one but you and I." "I need help, Lo. I can't do it myself. There's too much here." "I'll help you," Lurin said. "It'll take weeks." "I'll help you," he repeated. "No one else. Not a word to anyone else." Until 6 o'clock that evening, Lurin and I explored the treasure vault. "Let's find out where the other branch of the tunnel leads to," I suggested. "No," Lurin stopped me. "I want to keep normal hours here. I don't want the others to guess that we're up to something. We'll go down to the camp now. Tomorrow we'll have a look at the other fork of the tunnel. It can't be anything like this anyway." We closed the stone door behind us, sealing off the secret passage, and at the guard post Lurin made his orders clear, repeating them and writing them on the guard's instruction sheet. Ral's and Sally's names were removed from the list of those allowed into the tunnel. And later he mentioned it to them at dinner. He explained it away as an experiment that he and I were attempting. It was a difficult evening for me. I was overwrought by the day's excitement, and now that I'd shaken off my mood of apathy, I was overreacting to the normal stimuli of living. I found myself laughing too loudly, drinking too much, and the agony of my jealousy returned more intensely than ever. When Lurin and Sally looked at each other like that, I wanted to shout at them. I know about it, and damn you, I hate you for it. But then I knew it wasn't true. I didn't hate them. I loved them both, and this made it all the harder to bear. There was no chance of sleep for me that night. When I get myself into a certain state of nervous tension, then I can go for 2 or 3 nights without being able to still the racing of my overheated brain. I didn't mean to spy on her. It was a mere coincidence that I was standing at the window of my hut, staring out from my darkened room at the moonlight night, when Sally left her own hut. She wore a long, pale-coloured dressing gown, and her hair was let down in a dark cloud around her shoulders. She paused in the doorway of her own hut and looked around carefully, making sure that the camp was asleep. and then, guiltily, quickly, she hurried across the open moonlit yard to the hut in which Lurin was living. She opened the door and went in without hesitating, and for me a long, harrowing vigil had begun. I stood by my window for 2 hours, watching the moon shadows change shape, watching the patterns of the stars swing and turn across the heavens. Stars as fat and bright as they are only in the sweet, clean air of the wilderness. The beauty of it was wasted on me that night. I was watching Lorraine's hut, imagining each whispered word, each touch, each movement, and hating myself and them. I thought of Hilary and the children, wondering what madness it is that makes a man gamble his all on a few hours of transient pleasure. In that darkened hut, how many confidences were those two betraying? How many people's happiness were they risking? And then suddenly I realized that I was assuming that this affair was merely play on Lurin's part. And I faced the possibility that he was serious, that he would desert Hilary and go to Sally. I found this thought intolerable. I could no longer watch and wait. I must have some distraction, and I dressed quickly and hurried across to the repository. The night watchman greeted me sleepily, and I unlocked the door and went to the vault in which the golden books were kept. I took out the fourth book of Hui. I carried it across to my own office, and before I settled down to read, I went to fetch a bottle of Glen Grant, my two opiates, words and whiskey. I opened the scroll at random and reread Hui's ode to his battle axe, the gleaming wing of the bird of the sun. When I'd finished, I was taken by an impulse, and I lifted the great axe down from its place of honor. I caressed the shimmering length of it, studying it with new attention. I was convinced that this was the weapon of the poem. Could there be another answering the description so accurately? I held it in my lap, wishing that I could draw from it the story of the last days of Opet. I was sure it was involved intimately in the final tragedy. Why had it been left abandoned, a thing so well beloved and yet thrown carelessly aside, to lie uncared for and discarded for nearly 2,000 years? What had happened to the axeman Hui, and his king and his city? I read and dreamed, disturbed less frequently by thoughts of Sally and Lurin. However, at every pause in my readings, they came to me with a sick little slide of jealousy and despair in my guts. I was torn between the present and the distant past. I read on, sampling those portions of the scroll which were still unknown territory, while the level in the whiskey bottle sank slowly and the long night passed. And then, when midnight had flown and the new day was being born, I came upon a small piece of writing which touched a new depth of response in me. Hui makes a sudden heartfelt cry from the depth of his being. It is as though some long-suppressed emotion will no longer be contained and must come out in this appeal to have his physical form discounted when his value is assessed. From base earth flowers the purest gold, Hui cries. In his own poor distorted clay there were treasures concealed. I reread the passage half a dozen times, making sure of my translation, before I could accept that Hui Ben Ammon was like me, a cripple. Dawn's first promise was tracing the silhouette of the cliff tops with a pale rose colour when I laid the golden book away in its vault and walked slowly back towards my hut. Sally stepped out of Lurin's doorway and came towards me in the darkness. Her gown was ghostly pale, and she seemed to float above the ground. I stood still, hoping she wouldn't see me. There was a chance, for I stood in the deeper shadow of her hut, and I turned my face away, standing quietly. I heard the rustle of her skirts, the whisper of her feet in the dust, very close in the dark, and then her startled gasp as she saw me. I looked at her then. She had seen me, but not recognized me. Her face was a pale moon of fear, and her hands were at her mouth. "All right, Sally," I said. "It's only me." I could smell her now. On the clean night air of the desert, it was a perfumed smell, like crushed rose petals, and mingled with it the warm smell of perspiration and love. My heart slid in my chest. "Ben," she said, and we were both silent, staring at each other. "How long have you been here?"
"Long enough," I answered, and again the silence.
"You know, then." It was said in a small voice, shy and sad.
"I did not mean to spy," I said, and another silence.
"I believe you." She began to move away, and then she turned back. "Ben, I want to explain."
"You don't have to do that," I said.
"Yes, I do. I want to."
"It doesn't matter, Sal."
"It does matter."
"It does matter," she repeated.
"I don't want you to think that, well, that I'm so terrible."
"Forget it, Sally," I said.
"I tried not to, Ben. I swear to you. It's all right, Sally. I couldn't help it, truly. I tried so hard to fight it. I didn't want it to happen."
And she was crying now, silently, her shoulders shaking as she sobbed. "It doesn't matter," I said, and I went to her. I took her gently to her room and put her on the bed. In the light I saw how her lips were swollen and kiss inflamed. "Oh, Ben, I would have given anything for it to be different."
"I know, Sally. I tried so hard, but it was too much for me. He had me in some kind of spell from the very first moment I saw him.
That evening at the airport." I could not help her, but asked the question, remembering how she had watched Loren that first time she met him, and how later she had ranted against him.
"That's why, later with me, I mean, that's why..."
I didn't want to hear her answer, and yet I must know if she had first come to me, inflamed with thoughts of another man.
"No, Ben. No."
She tried to deny it, but she saw my eyes and turned her face away.
"Oh, Ben, I'm sorry. I didn't want to hurt you."
"Yes," I nodded.
"I truly didn't want to hurt you. You're so good, so gentle, and so different from him."
There were dark shadows of sleeplessness beneath her eyes, and the peach-coloured velvet of her cheek was rubbed pink by Lauren's unshaven skin. "Yes," I said, with my heart breaking.
"Oh, Ben, what shall I do?" she cried in distress. "I'm caught in this thing. I can't escape."
Has he said what he's going to do? Has he told you, well, that he will leave Hillary and marry you?"
"No,"
she shook her head. "Has he given you a reason?"
"No,
no,"
she caught my hand. "Oh, Ben, it's just fun for him. It's just a little adventure."
I said nothing, watching her lovely tortured face, glad at least that she knew about Loren, realized that he was a hunter and she the quarry. There'd been many Sallys in Loren's life, and there'd be many more. The lion must kill regularly. "Is there anything I can do, Sally?" I asked at last.
"No, Ben, I don't think so."
"If there is, tell me," I said, and moved towards the door.
"Ben,"
she stopped and sat up.
"Ben, do you still love me?"
I nodded without hesitation.
"Yes. Yes, I still love you."
"Thank you, Ben," and she sighed softly. "I don't think I could have taken it if you had turned away from me." "I'll never do that, Sally," I said, and walked out into the lemon and rose glow of dawn.